Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
Hi, it's Lynn here with my conversation about family and food with the irascible and charming Tony Bourdain. Tony, it is so good to have you back.
Good to be with you.
So, okay, we've got a family cookbook that you've done.
Yes.
But you know, I have to laugh, okay, because the family cookbook has duck fat, wild boar. There's about four tubs of different stocks in the fridge. So, tell me about how you cook at home.
Well, I have a very unusual, or I thought I had an unusual sort of non-nuclear dysfunctional extended family. I mean, my house is a sort of an absentee wife who pretty much abandoned me to become a professional jiu-jitsu and grappling expert. A daughter, a nine-year-old girl who grew up eating very adventurously, largely, I think, maybe because her mother's Italian and she was exposed to those kinds of food. A Filipino nanny and her son, who is my daughter's, essentially in all important ways but blood, my little girl's brother and best friend, and an extended family of Filipinos, visiting Brazilians and various grapplers and martial arts professionals, as well as a bunch of other knuckleheads coming in and out. So I found myself for the last 9 years cooking in a way, or cooking things that I really never did as a professional, and trying to, you know, live the role of the patriarch. So, I mean, this book reflects a guy who spent 30 years in the restaurant business who is now preparing school lunches for his little girl and, you know, cooking Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners for this big, dysfunctional, messy group of people. And I think, though the food is fairly straightforward, I don't want to give the impression that it's unapproachable. And there's also meatloaf and macaroni and cheese and right. The sort of thing a nine-year-old would like. I do bring up, you know, the kind of organizational skills to it that I picked up over all those years. I mean, I've cooked a lot of Thanksgivings professionally, and you know what I've learned, I think, would be very, very helpful to people who struggle with a big holiday meal and find themselves, you know, not even remembering eating because there's so much work involved.
Well, give me for instance with Thanksgiving, because this is the perennial question: how do I survive?
Yeah. Well, for a professional, Thanksgiving's a three-day operation. I mean, you make the cranberry relish, you know, 2 days in advance. It only gets better. You don't struggle. We don't make gravy in the pan. That never works. You know, where you deglaze the pan with water or flour, and supposedly you have some magical gravy. Who does that? You make a turkey stock, and then maybe you incorporate the drippings. You know, when you do that on the day before, perhaps, again, it's something that improves over by sitting and marrying up. And then most importantly, you don't carve the turkey at the table. I always prepare what I call a stunt turkey, you know, a small turkey that I roast and actually stuff, which I advise against actually stuffing your turkey. You know, I cook the stuffing on the side like I do in the restaurant. It's healthier and it's better and more controllable. But basically, I make a stunt turkey for display. And I show everybody the turkey with the little paper booties on it and the stuffing inside. They all go, ooh and ah. And then I whisk that back into the kitchen for myself for leftovers and turkey sandwiches tomorrow, which is what Thanksgiving's really all about as far as I'm concerned. And then I have my service turkey, which is a big turkey, which I take the breast off the bone. I remove all of the thigh and the drumstick. And, you know, I slice that breast into nice, attractive shingles, lay it out on my separately cooked stuffing, and I send out an immaculate-looking platter of portion-controlled, ready-to-go, you know, cookbook-ready turkey that people can actually eat. I'm not up there wrestling with this turkey, struggling to hack off a few pieces of scrawny white meat, you know, for people who are, you know, your turkey's getting cold while the other guy is, you know, waiting for me to figure out how to carve turkey off the bone at the table side without stabbing myself. In this way, you also ensure that everybody gets some white meat, some dark meat, whatever they like, because it's worth remembering that the murder rates spike enormously over the holidays, and I think a lot of that is turkey related.
Yeah, probably. I wonder, too, about the fact that people get together over the holidays that maybe haven't chosen to be there.
The other piece of it. This is a situation that's fraught with peril. And there's probably all sorts of simmering resentments going on. So you should be able to spend as much time at the table as possible. And you should be organized. It should be a pretty painless operation if you organize yourself correctly. And I think those kinds of realistic expectations, you know, when you throw a dinner party, you should be able to, A, enjoy the meal yourself, and B, spend time with your guests. You shouldn't be stirring risotto in the kitchen for 22 minutes while, you know, your guests are getting, you know, sort of bitter and drunk waiting for their food. And I also think a cookbook, and I hope to address this, and I hope I've addressed this in the book, a cookbook should have reasonable expectations. Unfortunately, no matter how well-intentioned, most cookbooks aren't particularly honest in their expectations. And I think a perfect example is any, like, Eggs Benedict. When you see a recipe for something like Eggs Benedict that always says, you know, after the, you know, put the poached egg on top of the muffin and the Canadian bacon, apply hollandaise sauce, recipe on page 260. You go to page 260, there's a recipe for hollandaise sauce. What it never tells you is professionals, you know, when professionals learn to make hollandaise sauce, they always screw it up the first time, the second time, the third time. It requires repetition. There is a wide margin for error. And I think I try to address in this book the things that will probably go wrong, may go wrong, how to correct them, why not to get down on yourself if it does go wrong, that you should allow extra time for screwing up once or twice so that you don't, you know, you don't get all of that stress and shame and self-loathing when it's not like it is in Ina's cookbook. You know, I don't live in Ina Garten world. I love her work, actually, but my apartment does not look like Ina's and my food doesn't look like that. And the food in the book is not, I think, the photos in the book are, you know, there are plates where there's not even any food left on them. It looks much more like my home after a meal than, you know, the sort of, you know, Martha Stewart land.
Well, there is something you say that sort of stopped me for a moment. You say that you really hate to admit that for you, there's more stress in cooking for a party of five at home than cranking out meals for 500 in a restaurant.
Much easier for me. I mean, I can crank out 500 turkey dinners standing on my head, but Thanksgiving, you know, five family members with all of that, you know, all that backstory coming and, or five anybody. I get nervous. So I have my prep and my mise en place. I am squared away. And I think, you know, one of my problems that I'll confess to you here is that even when I cook my daughter's school lunches and her dinners every night, whatever, you know, I'm away a lot. So I sort of mitigate my guilt of being away so much by over-parenting when I'm home. I have a cycle menu on my refrigerator, you know, like Tuesday will be this for the school lunch. And maybe if there are leftovers, I'll merchandise those into a sensible dinner. And, you know, that's a kind of and on vacation with my daughter, I'm always sort of trying to assault her with the greatest hits of my childhood. So I'm sort of over-aggressive in my parenting. I kind of want to give her the best. I'm like, you know, the maniacal Jewish mother chasing after a child. Eat, eat, eat. Don't you love me?
I can picture this. Our lunchbox, I mean, do the kids want to trade, or is it a case?
Well, I'm like the guy in Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, the chef in Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, where she's an object of curiosity at school because we play a game where I try not to repeat myself and do, you know, stuff that she goes to an Italian school and, you know, they don't see a lot of spam musubi. You know, other kids bring in spam musubi or nori rolls or I do some pretty elaborate kooky stuff that I'm sure the other kids, I actually take sort of a perverse pleasure in sending my daughter to school with stuff that I know she loves, but that those other kids' moms are definitely not making.
You know, you're a man after my own heart, I have to say that. You've gotten off a plane. It has been, you know, you've been filming nonstop. You come home, but you really want to make yourself something to eat.
Right.
What would it be?
Well, when I'm away, no matter how well I've been eating in Asia or Europe, first thing I want when I'm back in New York is a pastrami sandwich. I'm calling out the pastrami queen or Katz's, and I'm getting a, you know, a good pastrami sandwich, and you know, a good cheeseburger would be good as well. I want it, you know. That chances are they don't do that right anywhere else. And so that's the first thing. If I'm cooking for myself, again, something comfortable. I like making meatloaf. I like making cream of tomato soup that evokes the canned stuff that my mom would give me, you know, if I got bullied in school as a kid. Macaroni and cheese makes me happy. My daughter loves making ratatouille because she gets to cut vegetables with daddy and make him nervous.
Yeah, but you have a lot of opinions about a grilled cheese sandwich, if I remember.
I just, you know, grilled cheese sandwich is a thing of beauty. I'm okay with bacon or tomato, but, you know, I like processed cheese. It's a wonderful thing. I mean, I like goat cheese, too. I just don't want it in my, you know, I don't want it in my sandwich. Does it improve it? I think this is a constant struggle, you know, for the soul of cooking. It's ask yourself, particularly with a hamburger, you know, ask yourself, you know, does adding an avocado or truffle or foie gras, okay, it might be interesting, but does it make it better, more enjoyable, more pleasurable? I mean, chefs are supposed, cooks are supposed to be in the business of pleasure. And it might be dazzling, but does it make it better? And I reached out to Nathan Myhrvold, the former chief technology officer for director for Microsoft, to ask him about the perfect burger, not just taste-wise, but and texturally, but structurally, which is something that everybody seems to overlook with a seemingly simple thing like a burger. You know, do you want a fat tomato slice? It ruins the experience. What is the perfect bun? What kind of cheese would be perfect? And, it, you know, in my view, the perfect cheese for a cheeseburger is, you know, that cheese-like, you know, substance that come in the, you know, the bright orange don't occur in nature, you know, squares. Yeah, it holds your burger together.
Now, he is, you know, I think of him as the father or at least the communicator about modernist cuisine. So what did he come up with? What was the structure that he felt worked best?
We talked a lot about, you know, the ideal burger holds together as you eat it. It doesn't squirt major ingredients onto your chest. So, you know, putting too much lettuce on or any lettuce at all is dangerous. You know, do you want aioli on your burger? Does it make it better? Does blue cheese, is blue cheese a realistic expectation for a good burger eating experience? Is the brioche bun good or evil? In my view, it's an evil thing. So I believe we arrived at the potato bun. One or two burgers, maybe, you know, we're both fans of the smashed burger, American or American-like cheese. If you're going to do tomato, maybe one slice, but thin, because if it's too big, what you want to avoid is tectonic slide, where your burger starts shifting around. You want a representative bite of every layer in each mouthful. You don't want to be, you know, deconstructing your burger, especially from your chest.
And it's interesting what you say about the brioche bun. That and doing a burger or a sandwich with a croissant, both of which are loaded
with
butter.
It's grease on grease.
Yeah, yeah.
It's grease on grease. I like a greasy burger, and I like lots of cheese, but I think you need something to counter that. You know, I think this is why the pillowy potato roll, potato bun, is perfect, and Dr. Myhrvold fortunately agrees with me.
What is your take on ketchup or mustard or mayonnaise, the California concept of a burger?
Look, to each their own, I'm not a fan of mustard on burgers, but it's not a food crime in my view. Ketchup on a hot dog, I find it deeply, deeply offensive. And it's funny, I asked President Obama this on our view. I shared a meal with President Obama, and as a Chicagoan, you know, as a lame duck president not running for office, I figured he'd give me a straight answer. And I said, look, Mr. President, as a Chicagoan, as a true Chicagoan, is it ever acceptable to put ketchup on a hot dog? And I mean, you know, anybody else or anyone running for office would say, well, you know, to each their own, everybody gets their own. No, he said, no, never. And I said, oh, you know, he said, okay, after the age of 8, he said. After that, an intervention is required. And I agree. I don't think you should I think there's a time and a place for ketchup, and I don't think a hot dog is one of them. That's my opinion.
Tony, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's fun.
Tony Bourdain's cookbook is called Appetites.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.